WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome. Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
The vampire, the eroticism and repulsion he evokes as he rises from his grave. This is part of the Gothic sensibility, a sensibility that is very attractive to many young people. It's expressed in the music they listen to, the books they read, and the way they look. Black clothing, black fingernail polish, nearly black lipstick, very pale skin. My guest, Richard Davenport-Hines, has written a new book on the history of Gothic art, architecture, literature, and movies. It's called Gothic, 400 Years of Excess, Horror, Evil, and Ruin. Let's start with what the word Gothic means.
Originally, the word Gothic was used to indicate the style of architecture used in Europe in the Middle Ages to build churches and cathedrals, which was to do with spires soaring high into the sky to reach God, and was about spiritual elevation. But the type of Gothic imagination that I've been interested in is the opposite of that, and is art and pictures and books and later cinema trying to look at the darker side of human nature rather than the higher side of Christianity.
What is the look today that goes with goth?
Well, in Europe and the States and Australia, the look today is definitely one that's emphasised in black for the clothes, and cosmetic experiments that make you look spectral, that make you look vampiric or ghostly. And the whole attempt is to look in a playful way sinister. I don't think it's intended to look positively threatening, but it is intended to be a slightly camp joke about playing with ideas of evil.
You know, some people say that the goth style really appeals to people who aren't conventionally attractive, and because it's a way of being very defiant about mainstream values of conventional beauty. And it's a way of really expressing yourself without having to have, you know, the perfect nose or the perfect hairdo or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I go along with that very far. Mm-hmm. Partly because I think potentially the next great move in Gothic self-expression is going to be related to cosmetic surgery and people actually changing the shape of their bodies more dramatically. I couldn't dress up as a goth because I'm too stout and I just look silly. I'm not. I think you have to be thin and slightly wasted, slightly emaciated, as if you've been drained by a vampire, to look really good in the Gothic clothes.
Now, you point out in your book that goth has always had the versatility to provide the imagery to express the anxieties of the age, no matter what that age is. What anxieties do you think goth is expressing now?
Oh, I think the goth at the moment seems to me fighting the Disneyfication of the United States and of the European world, and the sense that family life can be a secure and containing experience, the sort of policies that were associated with Hillary Clinton's book about, which I think was called
It Takes a Village.
Exactly so. I would have thought that was absolutely the antithesis of what goths were about.
Not about community values or family values.
It's to say that community values are a fairly shallow control system, and an attempt in particular to tell people that life can be made safe, that life can be made secure, that boundaries and frontiers can be put on one's domestic existence that will last. And goths and the whole Gothic message for 300 years is that life is always perilous and dangerous, that one's circumstances are always insecure, and that you're likely to get walloped by a personal disaster or an emotional misfortune when you least expect it from the direction that you never imagined it was coming from.
What's the goth scene like in London? And I'm wondering what you think about when you pass, say, a group of teenagers who are all dressed in black with makeup to make them look more pale, and they're obviously like really deep into goth.
There's not a great deal of that visible just at the moment in London, except among people who go over and over again to see the Rocky Horror Show. That's not, I think, tremendously active at the moment in London. It's very different in the United States.
I wonder why you think that is, why it's still so popular in the United States but not in England.
I think it's because the cult of family life and the absolute veneration of family life is so much stronger in the United States, desperately unconvincing to many people who are living within families at the time, and that one of the ways that one can signal one's dissent from saying that being in a family is generally a really good experience or a really emotionally enriching experience or something that makes one feel politically a lot safer is by dressing up as a goth. I think we're a much less hierarchical and authoritarian society in that way in England and in most of Western Europe. So there isn't at the moment anything to fight against in that way.
I think there's a lot of fears in the United States about goth culture now. It's seen as antisocial and possibly dangerous and violent. For example, the shooters at the high school in Littleton were seen by some as being connected to goth culture. There are some schools that have been trying to ban goth clothing. I'm wondering if from your perspective, you see, you know, the goth sensibility as being potentially dangerous or leading to violence.
No, the opposite, substantially. All of the goths I know are rather gentle and frequently rather sensitive and reflective people and specifically not aggressive. And in a sense, their dressing up is an attempt to distance themselves from the rather more aggressive and competitive models of behaviour that you get from corporate society.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Davenport Hines. He's the author of the new book, Gothic, 400 Years of Excess, Horror, Evil, and Ruin. Where does the word gothic come from?
Well, it was essentially coined in England in the 1730s by noblemen who were building new types of landscape gardening for their country estates. And they'd got very excited by Italian pictures painted in the previous century by a very fashionable painter called Salvatore Rosa, who specialised in really spooky landscapes with dead, withered trees and with broken limbs, and men who'd hanged themselves from these trees, stuff like that. And the English aristocracy, including King George II, started planting their gardens with dead trees, amongst other things, just to create the spooky effect and to make their gardens look like pictures. And that's really, in European terms, when the word Gothic started in the 1730s.
I'd like you to choose a really influential goth image from painting or illustration. One of the earlier images that kind of reverberated it over decades or centuries.
Well, the Neapolitan painter Salvatore Rosa, who lived in the middle of the 17th century, painted one huge canvas called Witchcraft. A very long and dramatic piece with about 7 or 8 different forms of sorcery or cruelty or torture or macabre dressing up going on in them in isolated pockets. And none of the people in the picture seem aware of the existence of the other people next to them. They're not looking at each other. They're all absorbed in their own little private brand of evil or manipulation. And both the background and the details of the picture gave a huge amount to the way Gothic stories developed.
Now, a lot of the clothing that's associated with goth now has not only a kind of vampiric look about it, but also an S&M look about it. And I'm wondering where you see sadomasochistic sexuality as fitting in historically to the goth sensibility.
Well, I think they've existed in parallel all the time. I mean, sadomasochism as a concept and as a practice is recognized at exactly the same time in the 18th century that Gothic novels take off. And Gothic novels become popular precisely because of the way they explore power relationships between people. And in Gothic novels of that period, very frequently you have a dominating figure who appears to be in control of the situation. And in fact, the people who are obliged to submit to him sexually and economically in these novels, by their act of submission, if they submit completely enough without qualification, actually come into the stronger power relationship. That's the recurrent plot of many of the novels by Horace Walpole or Mrs. Radcliffe from the 1780s and 1790s. And it's an idea that in a much more confused and overheated way that the Marquis de Sade explores too. There are lots of other novelists I could mention. Monk, Matthew Lewis, who wrote The Monk in the 1790s as a reaction to the French Revolution, very much explores that sort of inversion of power relationships.
So domination and submission are kind of constant themes in Goth literature?
Well, always, yes. And very frequently in the earlier period, it was rather like your Hays Code. It was really not culturally acceptable for the villain to get away with being a villain without retribution coming at the end of the novel. So that in a sense there was a moral censorship of the endings of these stories. But yes, that was very much the preoccupation in the 18th century.
My guest is Richard Davenport Hines, author of the new book, Gothic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Richard Davenport Hines, author of Gothic, 400 Years of Excess, Horror, Evil, and Ruin. Vampire stories, particularly the Dracula story, are a real kind of cornerstone of the goth sensibility. When did goth and vampire start getting connected?
That's a question that's very difficult to answer. I, in a way, the answer is only with Hollywood in the 1930s. And although you have early vampire stories, one written by Lord Byron, and later, of course, Bram Stoker's Count Dracula, and other very good ones in the 19th century, it's only when Hollywood discovers that there's money to be made out of horror, and reasonably inexpensive films make a lot of money if they have Frankenstein or Dracula in them. And that's the way Gothic enters the cultural mainstream. I mean, that's the really important contribution of Gothic in the 20th century, is through these films that were made by people like James Whale.
You describe James Whale as Hollywood's earliest and greatest Gothic film director. His most famous film is Frankenstein. Where do you see Frankenstein as fitting in?
Well, it is still visually tremendously exciting, but the way it fits in is the beginning of everything, because Gothic novels had always been tremendously self-referential and elusive between them, and they picked up the same ideas and repeated them, sometimes quite teasingly, sometimes quite mockingly, but they repeated them. And that's exactly what James Whale's Frankenstein film and then Bride of Frankenstein film both do. They set up all the visual images which Gothic filmmakers ever since have had to go back to, play around with, allude to, move on from, and then end up with all over again. It's the moment when Gothic self-reference and film self-reference come together is immensely influential in 20th century popular culture.
Patrick McGrath is one of the most successful writers now of what he describes as new Gothic fiction. And I'm wondering how you think this new Gothic fiction that's being published today compares in sensibility and subject matter to earlier Gothic fiction?
In many respects, it has it is superior, tragically superior, because the superiority comes from the fact that we're living in a world since Auschwitz and Buchenwald and so forth, and the concentration camp horrors of the 1940s and Russia in the 1950s. The Gothic imagination's low point was certainly in the period immediately after the Second World War, when you simply couldn't write seriously or playfully in the Gothic way about large scale cruelty and horror, and that's the real difference between the old Gothic and the new. And McGrath is in his books recognizes that good and evil are really serious issues, not to be treated irresponsibly. Some of the Gothic writers who were writing, in my opinion, who were writing in the 1920s and the early 20th century, and certainly in this country, were rather emotionally shallow, slightly erotically perverted upper-class English bachelors, sort of rather what we'd call in England anyway, dirty old men. And their idea of evil was actually very boring, shallow, and became rather disgusting after the concentration camp experience. That's the difference I'd really emphasize.
What's your personal interest in Gothic art and the Gothic sensibility?
I'm tremendously un-Gothic in my own personal living arrangements. I like my life to be serene and understated. So I was very interested in people who were the opposite. Goths are histrionic, extremist. They behave quintessentially like the senior management of an opera house. And I'm hugely not like that, but I wanted to know a bit more about what it was like being like that.
I wonder if there were any novels or films or paintings, illustrations that reached you in your formative years that you've come to think of as being a part of this Goth sensibility.
I think that there are so many different forms of the Goth sensibility which can hit one, so that I have had phases in which I've found the idea of dank and decayed, ruined gardens with broken temples and dead trees and so forth, which is a very expressive of ideas about the transience of human power. And I think that something I responded to very immediately. And also the idea that tyrants really aren't in control of their autocracies, which is something Abraham Lincoln, I think, realised. W.H. Auden said that Lincoln was a genius because he realised that he really wasn't in control of most of the actions that resulted from his decisions, that having taken a decision, you then have to rely on other people to implement them, and your subordinates are frequently very unsatisfactory or treacherous or inept. And that, as I've said, is one of the great messages about of the Gothic imagination, that powerful men actually are absolute victims of the situation that they fight to put themselves in. And I found that recurrently very satisfying thought.
I think in pop culture now, one of the main vehicles for the Goth sensibility is music. And there have been some bands that really just kind of specialize in that. Why don't we end with some music? How about the Bauhaus recording, Bela Lugosi's Dead? Do you want to say something about this?
Only that I like it very much, and that although I much prefer talking on radio to appearing on television, this is sort of occasion when I'm sorry you can't show a video of the Bauhaus really highly decorated in their both in their costumes and in their cosmetics singing this, because they were visually very emphatic and made the most tremendous impact as they sing it. And it is a tremendous set of lyrics in terms of their elusiveness and their historical grounding and what being a Goth has always been about.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
No, thank you.
My guest has been Richard Davenport Hines. His new book is called Gothic, 400 Years of Excess, Horror, Evil, and Ruin. And here's Bauhaus.
White on white, translucent black capes, back on the rack. Bela Lugosi's dead, the bats have left the bell tower. The victims have been bled, red velvet lines, the black box. Bela Lugosi's dead. Bela Lugosi's dead.
This is Fresh Air.